The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. We are continuing to read House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. And in our last episode, our protagonist was being attacked by bizarre pig-like monsters, and right now they seem to have retreated, so we're going to see what happens from here. After the attack. It was now about 3 a.m., and presently the eastern sky began to pale with the coming of dawn. Gradually the day came, and by its light I scanned the gardens earnestly, but nowhere could I see any sign of the brutes. I leant over and glanced down to the foot of the wall to see whether the body of the thing I had shot the night before was still there. It was gone. I suppose that others of the monsters had removed it during the night. Then I went down onto the roof and crossed over to the gap from which the coping stone had fallen. Reaching it, I looked over. Yes, there was the stone, as I had seen it last, but there was no appearance of anything beneath it, nor could I see the creature I had killed after its fall. Evidently, they also had been taken away. I turned and went down to my study. There I sat down wearily. I was thoroughly tired. It was quite light now, though the sun's rays were not, as yet, perceptibly hot. A clock chimed the hour of 4. I awoke with a start and looked round hurriedly. The clock in the corner indicated that it was 3 o'clock. It was already afternoon. I must have slept for nearly 11 hours. With a jerky movement, I sat forward in the chair and listened. The house was perfectly silent. Slowly, I stood up and yawned. I felt desperately tired still and sat down again, wondering what it was that had waked me. It must have been the clock striking, I concluded presently, and was commencing to doze off when a sudden noise brought me back once more to life. It was the sound of a step, as of a person moving cautiously down the corridor towards my study. In an instant, I was on my feet and grasping my rifle. Noiselessly, I waited. Had the creatures broken in whilst I slept? Even as I questioned, the steps reached my door, halted momentarily, and then continued down the passage. Silently, I tiptoed to the doorway and peeped out. Then, I experienced such a feeling of relief, as must a reprieved criminal. It was my sister. She was going towards the stairs. I stepped into the hall and was about to call to her when it occurred to me that it was very strange she should have crept past my door in that stealthy manner. I was puzzled, and for one brief moment the thought occupied my mind that it was not she, but some fresh mystery of the house. Then, as I caught a glimpse of her old petticoat, the thought passed as quickly as it had come, and I half laughed. There could be no mistaking that ancient garment. Yet, I wondered what she was doing. And remembering her condition of mind on the previous day, I felt that it might be best to follow quietly, taking care not to alarm her, and see what she was going to do. If she behaved rationally, well and good. If not, I should have to take steps to restrain her. I could run no unnecessary risks under the danger that threatened us. Quickly, I reached the head of the stairs and paused a moment. Then, I heard a sound that sent me leaping down at a mad rate. It was the rattle of bolts being unshot. That foolish sister of mine was actually unbarring the back door. Just as her hand was on the last bolt, I reached her. She had not seen me, and the first thing she knew, I had hold of her arm. She glanced up quickly, like a frightened animal, and screamed aloud. "Come, Mary," I said sternly. "What's the meaning of this nonsense? Do you mean to tell me you don't understand the danger, that you try to throw our two lives away in this fashion?" To this she replied nothing, only trembled violently, gasping and sobbing as though in the last extremity of fear. Through some minutes I reasoned with her, pointing out the need for caution and asking her to be brave. There was little to be afraid of now, I explained, and I tried to believe that I spoke the truth. But she must be sensible and not attempt to leave the house for a few days. At last I ceased in despair. It was no use talking to her. She was obviously not quite herself for the time being. Finally, I told her she had better go to her room if she could not behave rationally. Still, she took not any notice. So, without more ado, I picked her up in my arms and carried her there. At first she screamed wildly, but had relapsed into silent trembling by the time I reached the stairs. Arriving at her room, I laid her upon the bed. She lay there quietly enough, neither speaking nor sobbing, just shaking in a very ague of fear. I took a rug from a chair nearby and spread it over her. I could do nothing more for her, and so crossed to where Pepper lay in a big basket. My sister had taken charge of him since his wound to nurse him, for it had proved more severe than I had thought, and I was pleased to note that, in spite of her state of mind, she had looked after the old dog carefully. Stooping, I spoke to him, and in reply, he licked my hand feebly. He was too ill to do more. Then, going to the bed, I bent over my sister and asked her how she felt. But she only shook the more, and much as it pained me, I had to admit that my presence seemed to make her worse. And so I left her, locking the door and pocketing the key. It seemed to be the only course to take. The rest of the day I spent between the tower and my study. For food, I brought up a loaf from the pantry, and on this and some claret, I lived for the day. What a long, weary day it was. If only I could have gone out into the gardens, as is my wont, I should have been content enough. But to be cooped in this silent house with no companion, save a mad woman and a sick dog, was enough to prey upon the nerves of the hardiest. And out in the tangled shrubberies that surrounded the house lurked, for all I could tell, those infernal swine creatures waiting their chance. Was ever a man in such straits? Once in the afternoon, and again later, I went to visit my sister. The second time I found her tending Pepper, but at my approach she slid over unobtrusively to the far corner with a gesture that saddened me beyond belief. Poor girl! Her fear cut me intolerably, and I would not intrude on her unnecessarily. She would be better, I trusted, in a few days. Meanwhile, I could do nothing, and I judged it still needful, hard as it seemed, to keep her confined to her room. One thing there was that I took for encouragement. She had eaten some of the food I had taken to her on my first visit. And so the day passed. As the evening drew on, the air grew chilly, and I began to make preparations for passing a second night in the tower, taking up two additional rifles and a heavy ulster. The rifles I loaded and laid alongside my other, as I intended to make things warm for any of the creatures who might show during the night. I had plenty of ammunition, and I thought to give the brutes such a lesson as should show them the uselessness of attempting to force an entrance. After that, I made the round of the house again, paying particular attention to the props that supported the study door. Then, feeling that I had done all that lay in my power to ensure our safety, I returned to the tower, calling in on my sister and Pepper for a final visit on the way. Pepper was asleep, but woke as I entered and wagged his tail in recognition. I thought he seemed slightly better. My sister was lying on the bed, though whether asleep or not, I was unable to tell, and thus I left them. Reaching the tower, I made myself as comfortable as circumstances would permit and settled down to watch through the night. Gradually, darkness fell, and soon the details of the gardens were merged into shadows. During the first few hours, I sat, alert, listening for any sound that might help to tell me if anything were stirring down below. It was far too dark for my eyes to be of much use. Slowly, the hours passed, without anything unusual happening, and the moon rose, showing the gardens apparently empty and silent, and so toward the night without disturbance or sound. Towards morning, I began to grow stiff and cold with my long vigil. Also, I was getting very uneasy concerning the continued quietness on the part of the creatures. I mistrusted it, and would sooner far have had them attack the house openly. Then, at least, I should have known my danger and been able to meet it. But to wait like this, through a whole night, picturing all kinds of unknown devilment, was to jeopardize one's sanity. Once or twice the thought came to me that perhaps they had gone, but in my heart I found it impossible to believe it was so. So far things seem okay, but a little odd. Why is his sister afraid of him? Did she not see the swine creatures? Can she see the swine creatures? Is it something only he can see? Who knows? We'll find out more after a message from our sponsor.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
Hi, this is Sean Sayre, Executive Director of PCTV. When Taconic High School was demolished, we could have lost this radio station. Instead, PCTV stepped in, built a new studio and transmitter, and gave the station new life. And now it's time to pay that back. Support this station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click the donate button. You won't be sorry. Pittsfield Community Radio thanks you for your support.
Hi, I'm Leslie Hertzberg, Executive Director of the Berkshire County Historical Society. Spring through fall, we look forward to welcoming you for tours of Herman Melville's historic home, Arrowhead. We offer a wide variety of in-person and virtual programs throughout the year. Visit berkshirehistory.org for information on programs and to schedule a tour.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
This is Kevin Cahill from the Sunday Sounds of Ireland show, which you can listen to every Sunday on WTBR 89.7 at 10 a.m. You will hear the jigs, you will hear the reels, the fiddles, the bowrons, and the bagpipes, Paddy Riley, the Wolf Tones, the Chieftains, and even some cranberries. So listen to the Sunday Sounds of Ireland every Sunday at 10 a.m. here at WTBR 89.7.
And we're back. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners, reading The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. In the Cellars. At last, what with being tired and cold and the uneasiness that possessed me, I resolved to take a walk through the house. First calling in at the study for a glass of brandy to warm me. This I did, and while there, I examined the door carefully, but found all as I had left it the night before. The day was just breaking as I left the tower, though it was still too dark in the house to be able to see without a light, and I took one of the study candles with me on my round. By the time I had finished the ground floor, the daylight was creeping in, wanly, through the barred windows. My search had shown me nothing fresh. Everything appeared to be in order, and I was on the point of extinguishing my candle when the thought suggested itself to me to have another glance round the cellars. I had not, if I remembered rightly, been into them since my hasty search on the evening of the attack. For perhaps the half of a minute, I hesitated. I would have been very willing to forego the task, as indeed I am inclined to think any man well might. For of all the great, awe-inspiring rooms in this house, the cellars are the hugest and weirdest. Great, gloomy caverns of places, unlit by any ray of daylight. Yet I would not shirk the work. I felt that to do so would smack of sheer cowardice. Besides, as I reassured myself, the cellars were really the most unlikely places in which to come across anything dangerous. Considering that they can be entered only through a heavy oaken door, the key of which I carry always on my person. It is in the smallest of these places that I keep my wine, a gloomy hole close to the foot of the cellar stairs, and beyond which I have seldom proceeded. Indeed, save for the rummage round already mentioned, I doubt whether I had ever before been right through the cellars. As I unlocked the great door at the top of the steps, I paused nervously a moment at the strange, desolate smell that assailed my nostrils. Then, throwing the barrel of my weapon forward, I descended slowly into the darkness of the underground regions. Reaching the bottom of the stairs, I stood for a minute and listened. All was silent save for a faint drip, drip of water, falling drop by drop by somewhere to my left. As I stood, I noticed how quietly the candle burnt. Never a flicker nor flare, so utterly windless was the place. Quickly I moved from cellar to cellar. I had but a very dim memory of their arrangement. The impressions left by my first search were blurred. I had recollections of a succession of great cellars, and of one greater than the rest, the roof of which was upheld by pillars. Beyond that, my mind was hazy and predominated by a sense of cold and darkness and shadows. Now, however, it was different, for although nervous, I was sufficiently collected to be able to look about me and note the structure and size of the different vaults I entered. Of course, with the amount of light given by my candle, it was not possible to examine each place minutely, but I was enabled to notice as I went along the walls appeared to be built with wonderful precision and finish, while here and there an occasional massive pillar shot up to support the vaulted roof. Thus I came at last to the great cellar that I remembered. It is reached through a huge, arched entrance on which I observed strange, fantastic carvings, which threw weird shadows under the light of my candle. As I stood and examined these thoughtfully, it occurred to me how strange it was that I should be so little acquainted with my own house. Yet this may be easily understood when one realizes the size of this ancient pile and the fact that only my old sister and I live in it, occupying a few of the rooms such as our wants decide. Holding the light high, I passed on into the cellar, and keeping to the right, paced slowly up until I reached the further end. I walked quietly and looked cautiously about as I went. But so far as the light showed, I saw nothing unusual. At the top, I turned to the left, still keeping to the wall, and so continued until I traversed the whole of the vast chamber. As I moved along, I noticed that the floor was comprised of solid rock, in places covered with a damp mold, in others bare, or almost so, save for a thin coating of light gray dust. I had halted at the doorway. Now, however, I turned and made my way up the center of the place, passing among the pillars and glancing to right and left as I moved. About halfway up the cellar, I stubbed my foot against something that gave out a metallic sound. Stooping quickly, I held the candle and saw that the object I had kicked was a large metal ring. Bending lower, I cleared the dust from around it and presently discovered that it was attached to a ponderous trapdoor, black with age. Feeling excited and wondering to where it could lead, I laid my gun on the floor and, sticking the candle in the trigger guard, took the rein in both hands and pulled. The trap creaked loudly, the sound echoing vaguely through the huge place, and opened heavily. Propping the edge on my knee, I reached for the candle and held it in the opening, moving it to right and left, but could see nothing. I was puzzled and surprised. There were no signs of steps, nor even the appearance of there ever having been any. Nothing, save an empty blackness. I might have been looking down into a bottomless, sideless well. Then, even as I stared, full of perplexity, I seemed to hear far down, as though from untold depths, a faint whisper of sound. I bent my head quickly more into the opening and listened intently. It may have been fancy, but I could have sworn to hearing a soft titter that grew into a hideous chuckling, faint and distant. Startled, I leapt backwards, letting the trap fall with a hollow clang that filled the place with echoes. Even then, I seemed to hear that mocking, suggestive laughter. But this, I knew, must be my imagination. The sound I had heard was far too slight to penetrate through the cumbrous trap. For a full minute, I stood there, quivering, glancing nervously behind and before. But the great cellar was silent as a grave, and gradually I shook off the frightened sensation. With a calmer mind, I became again curious to know into what that trap opened, but could not then summon sufficient courage to make a further investigation. One thing I felt, however, was that the trap ought to be secured. This I accomplished by placing upon it several large pieces of dressed stone, which I had noticed in my tour along the east wall. Then, after a final scrutiny of the rest of the place, I retraced my way through the cellars to the stairs, and so reached the daylight with an infinite feeling of relief that the uncomfortable task was accomplished. The time of waiting. The sun was now warm and shining brightly, forming a wondrous contrast to the dark and dismal cellars, and it was with comparatively light feelings that I made my way up to the tower to survey the gardens. There I found everything quiet, and after a few minutes went down to Mary's room. Here, having knocked and received a reply, I unlocked the door. My sister was sitting quietly on the bed, as though waiting. She seemed quite herself again and made no attempt to move away as I approached. Yet I observed that she scanned my face anxiously, as though in doubt, and but half assured in her mind that there was nothing to fear from me. To my questions as to how she felt, she replied sanely enough that she was hungry and would like to go down to prepare breakfast if I did not mind. For a minute, I meditated whether it would be safe to let her out. Finally, I told her she might go, on condition that she promised not to attempt to leave the house or meddle with any of the outer doors. At my mention of the doors, a sudden look of fright crossed her face. But she said nothing save to give the required promise and then left the room silently. Crossing the floor, I approached Pepper. He had waked as I entered, but beyond a slight yelp of pleasure and a soft rapping with his tail, had kept quiet. Now, as I patted him, he made an attempt to stand up and succeeded, only to fall back on his side with a little yowl of pain. I spoke to him and bade him lie still. I was greatly delighted with his improvement and also with the natural kindness of my sister's heart in taking such good care of him in spite of her condition of mind. After a while, I left him and went downstairs to my study. In a little while, Mary appeared, carrying a tray on which smoked a hot breakfast. As she entered the room, I saw her gaze fasten on to the props that supported the study door. Her lips tightened, and I thought she paled slightly, but that was all. Putting the tray down at my elbow, she was leaving the room quietly when I called her back. She came, it seemed, a little timidly, as though startled, and I noted that her hand clutched at her apron nervously. "Come, Mary," I said. "Cheer up. Things look brighter. I've seen none of the creature since yesterday morning, early. She looked at me in a curiously puzzled manner, as though not comprehending. Then intelligence swept into her eyes and fear, but she said nothing beyond an unintelligible murmur of acquiescence. After that, I kept silence. It was evidence that any reference to the swine things was more than her shaken nerves could bear. Breakfast over, I went up to the tower. Here, during the greater part of the day, I maintained a strict watch over the gardens. Once or twice, I went down to the basement to see how my sister was getting along. Each time, I found her quiet and curiously submissive. Indeed, on the last occasion, she even ventured to address me on her own account with regard to some household matter that needed attention. Though this was done with an almost extraordinary timidity, I hailed it with happiness as being the first word voluntarily spoken since the critical moment when I had caught her unbarring the back door to go out among those waiting brutes. I wondered whether she was aware of her attempt and how near a thing it had been, but refrained from questioning her, thinking it best to let well alone. That night, I slept in a bed, the first time for 2 nights. In the morning, I rose early and took a walk around the house. All was as it should be, and I went up to the tower to have a look at the gardens. Here, again, I found perfect quietness. At breakfast, when I met Mary, I was greatly pleased to see that she had sufficiently regained command over herself to be able to greet me in a perfectly natural manner. She talked sensibly and quietly, only keeping carefully from any mention of the past couple of days. In this, I humored her, to the extent of not attempting to lead the conversation in that direction. Earlier in the morning, I had been to see Pepper. He was mending rapidly and bade fair to be on his legs in earnest in another day or two. Before leaving the breakfast table, I made some reference to his improvement. In the short discussion that followed, I was surprised to gather from my sister's remarks that she was still under the impression that his wound had been given by the wildcat of my invention. It made me feel almost ashamed of myself for deceiving her. Yet the lie had been told to prevent her from being frightened. And then, I had been sure she must have known the truth later when those brutes had attacked the house. During the day, I kept on the alert, spending much of my time, as on the previous day, in the tower. But not a sign could I see of the swine creatures, nor hear any sound. Several times the thought had come to me that the things had at last left us. But, up to this time, I had refused to entertain the idea seriously. Now, however, I began to feel there was reason for hope. It would soon be 3 days since I had seen any of the things, but still I intended to use the utmost caution. For all that I could tell, this protracted silence might be a ruse to tempt me from the house, perhaps right into their arms. The thought of such a contingency was, alone, sufficient to make me circumspect. So it was that the 4th, 5th, and 6th days went by quietly, without my making any attempt to leave the house. On the 6th day, I had the pleasure of seeing Pepper once more upon his feet, and though still very weak, he managed to keep me company during the whole of the day. And that's it for today. Well, so far it seems that the creatures are gone. Or are they? They might, as the narrator suspects, just be trying to lull him into a false sense of security. And why doesn't the sister seem aware of what's happening? Like I wondered before, is she able to see the swine creatures like he does? Are they even real? Who knows? Hopefully we'll find out more next time on Page Turners. As usual, this is Margaret Dixon. I enjoyed reading to you, and I hope you enjoyed listening.